We conclude today's program with The Left and the Law, talking about conspiracy theories and how they take hold. Jan?
Well, Mike, you and I have both written books on the satanic ritual abuse scare of the 1980s and 90s and how that conspiracy theory took hold. The belief that a vast network of Satan-worshipping pedophiles was sexually abusing children, leaving cryptic codes among survivors, signaling their existence. Now, some of these same ideas are resurgent with QAnon, a conspiracy theory circulating on the dark web that has many of these same plot elements. Let's start with QAnon as a conspiracy theory and then take up how this compares to what we saw in the late 20th century.
QAnon, unlike what happened in the 80s and 90s, comes from the fringes, comes from people who feel out of it. It's an effort to explain domination of the new elites, which are basically Democrats and high-tech people, Hollywood, all groups who are doing very well in today's economy. And it gains some legitimacy from its emphasis on children. You know, it has the same tropes as conspiracies against Jews in Russia did in the 19th century, against the elites that have been around for quite some time, actually back to the French Revolution, when it was rumored that Marie Antoinette ate children in order to extend her life and had sexual abuse of all sorts with her own children and with other children. These are common tropes on the edge. I think the
because
most striking...
they symbolize young children, particularly are symbols of purity, but also of vulnerability, and elicit a kind of moral call for protection. And of course, there are actual progressive movements and campaigns that also emphasize protection of innocent children. So how do we distinguish between, you know, Save the Children campaigns, organizations that really are important in addressing a social problem versus conspiracy theories based on some of these same motifs?
It's tricky. I mean, President Trump's only acknowledgement of QAnon was when he said, "I hear they're very strong against pedophilia." So it's a way of licensing, of covering them up with a mantle of respectability, being opposed to damaging children. Who can be against that?
Yeah, and I think there are many defenders or kind of casual QAnon followers who point out that people like Jeffrey Epstein and exposés of trafficking in children and pedophilia are true demonstrated threats to children. So how do we distinguish between a conspiracy theory and a progressive campaign?
Well, it shouldn't be hard. There's no magic formula. You just have to see what people are actually doing. I mean, these rumors now, because it's a fringe group and not like it was led by the authorities back in the 80s and 90s, when district attorneys and politicians and nightly newscasters were promulgating it. Now it's a fringe group, so it spreads without any evidence. It spreads the way folklore spreads. It spreads on the way you got ideas when you were a school kid from your friends. And nowadays with social media, with your trusted websites, the ones where you can go and find people who are like you. The way to distinguish is to rely on evidence. You know, science, scientific thinking or thinking slowly is appropriate. That would mean that we want to see if Hillary Clinton is supposedly devouring babies for adrenochrome. You know, who are the mothers of these babies? Where are they coming from? What's the evidence? Whoever saw this? Things like percipient witnesses become important if you're talking about true protection of anybody's rights and of children.
And the more vast the conspiracy and the more it encompasses and the more people involved and the more outlandish the claims, the standard of evidence rises, right? That then it puts more of a obligation of evidence, because in general, true conspiracies over time are hard to hold together. Usually someone will expose it. And the more complex conspiracy and the bigger the network, the more difficult it is to remain secret. So one of the psychological aspects of conspiratorial thinking is that they are, as a group and as individuals, quite impervious to rules of evidence, because those who generate the rules of evidence, whether science, media, or scholars, are seen as suspect. And so this whole convention on QAnon, do your research, draws you back into QAnon. And it's a very difficult problem because of this resistance to the normal rules of evidence in the QAnon world.
Yeah, so there's no way you can confront anybody with objective evidence. Pizzagate is a classic. It was a rumor that Democrat politicians in Washington, D.C. were gathering in the basement of his Comet Pizza Parlor and having their way with children and doing evil and unspeakable things. And somebody showed up with a gun in order to take action and stop this. And it turned out there was no basement at all at this place. It was an ordinary pizza parlor. But there is simply no way of refuting these beliefs. They're rooted not in any perception, but rather in a sense of being outside the mainstream. You deal with it by, I think, creating a more equitable society. People are now targeting QAnon on Democrats and high-tech people and Hollywood. And these are precisely the parts of the economy that are doing well. The Democratic Party is no longer the party of Franklin Roosevelt. It has evolved over the years to the party of technologically equipped and successful people.
Historian Richard Hofstadter wrote an article and then a book starting in the 1960s with what he called the paranoid style of American politics, and how fringe groups and fringe ideas and conspiratorial thinking could take hold in American politics and partly took up some of the features of American society that fostered this style, a kind of distrust of academics, distrust of science, and the political clash, you might call it. Do you think there were similar dynamics in the late 20th century? I mean, both you and I came into the satanic ritual abuse, what some called a panic, SRA panic, through different pathways, you through the criminal justice system, and I became interested in what was going on here through its being widely adopted by clinicians in the mental health community and many feminists, including feminist crisis lines, teaching trainees, students how to listen for these subtle cues, not in the same sense of QAnon, but there was some of that thinking that this was a vast, powerful network of Satanists who were so effective at covering their tracks and leaving buried away in the unconscious of survivors subtle cues or codes to detect their whereabouts. And in the 1990s, when I questioned this, it was not an easy thing to question. There was enormous resistance to questioning, even though there was almost no evidence in support of these claims. They had widespread support. So I became interested in trying to understand what made feminists also during that era vulnerable to accepting the satanic ritual abuse conspiracy. And perhaps we can talk about that, but can you say something about how you came into this era of conspiracy theory through your own work?
Well, right. I was randomly assigned cases after having taken time off from being a lawyer. I got criminal cases sent to me from Fresno, California, by the Court of Appeals that included, there was a truckload of transcripts about people who had been convicted and sentenced to centuries in prison for committing these horrible crimes. And my natural take then was, being somewhat skeptical, that there is probably something that happened, but it's probably exaggerated.
Like this, where there's smoke, there's fire kind of idea.
Exactly. But it took me some time to realize that there was absolutely nothing supporting this at all, other than the fever dreams of the investigators themselves. And then when I would say this at a party, you're right, it would be a very embarrassing, thick moment there, because all the best people at that time were convinced that this was happening. And that's what drove me into writing a book with Debbie Nathan about not the poor devils who got caught up and sentenced to long terms in prison, but rather, why did everybody, including me, think there was something to it?
We met on these same rocky cliffs of our fields during that same era.
That's right. Well, gradually, over time, the criminal justice system's opportunities to do further investigation and the passage of time itself made it possible to expose that the lack of truth of any of this. It was very much like the last time when the authorities were in charge and insisted that this was happening, which was Salem, Massachusetts. You know, the echoes, the parallels struck me very strongly.
The Salem witch trials.
Yeah, the witch trials. What people don't know is that if you confessed to being a witch in Salem, you were not hurt. You had reaffirmed the official view of reality. It was only those people who said, this is crazy, I'm not a witch, who were hanged or in one case crushed to death by rocks. And in one of my criminal cases, one of the marginal people, the eighth defendant, was told that she could regain custody of her children and do one brief period of probation if she would identify these others and testify against them. She refused, ended up getting the longest sentence of any of the eight defendants, was sentenced to prison for 340 years.
This was also an important shift. Initially, most of those accused were very much the patriarchs of the culture, fathers, ministers, priests, who had rightfully been, you know, indicted culturally and politically and sometimes criminally for abuse of women and children. But then as the stories became more dramatic and extended beyond that early period of confronting child sexual abuse, confronting abuse of women, they also came to have more women targeted as mothers, as teachers, and that kind of opened a door for me as a feminist to challenge this on a new level. I mean, my own take on it was not just to demonstrate. I think you were working in a judicial way to expose the evidential gaps around these claims. But I was also interested in why they took hold with such intensity, given the lack of evidence, and came to a line of analysis that the mass movement of feminism and the social movements of the 70s had stirred tremendous possibilities and opened horizons for women that shut very ferociously during the Reagan era, the expansion of neoliberalism, and the dismantling of the welfare state and social welfare services in the 80s and 90s. And it took an increasingly dramatic story to break through this rising threshold of unresponsiveness to the suffering of women and everyday people. And so there was, I think, an element of what you might call mass hysteria. I don't mean that in even a pathological sense, but a sense of how urgency can take hold to be heard if your voice is becoming weaker and weaker. So I saw it as signaling a crisis in the women's movement that led to a vulnerability of these kinds of outrageous stories that now have been kind of left behind by many as a kind of embarrassment of the past. And it's been hard for many in the field, including the mental health field, to recognize how widely they were accepted during that era.
That's true.
Would you bring a similar assessment now, just in our last minute or so, returning to the QAnon conspiracy and whether this also signals a crisis within the right in this country, a kind of rise in aspirations over the last two decades and now a period of losing cultural ground and political ground. And so perhaps is a last gasp that takes the form of this very paranoid group pathological phenomenon.
Well, whether it's a last gasp or not will depend on whether broad economic changes happen. The 80s and 90s, we had this strange, unique development of a large-scale entry of women into the workforce and away from the home and away from taking care of children, and a corresponding huge increase in daycare and all sorts of difficulties in absorbing these monumental changes, new possibilities, new obligations.
Yeah, with fundamentally no public support for that in this country.
Well, if I think we can spread the economy around, that will lessen the need for these explanations. But if there are continued development of inequality in this country, if people feel totally left behind, if whole swaths of the economy of many parts of their country, many regions are left behind, they're going to wonder, how did this happen? Why did it happen? What's going on? And the sense of conspiracies that we're hearing are going to flourish. They're going to proliferate, take different forms.
So course, we should continue to see not just quell or banish or control these conspiracy theories, which is perhaps one important part of it, but understand their signal value.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Mike, we'll continue to follow this and hopefully have meaningful responses to it. This is Jan Hocken talking today with Mike Snedeker about QAnon and conspiracy theories now and in the late 20th century.